we're taking a look at the week in Washington. The House Judiciary Committee is getting ready to launch its portion of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The Democratic presidential field has two new candidates, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says an agreement on the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal is close, but President Trump says he wants a vote on the deal immediately. And we want to hear from you. You can share your thoughts on the USMCA at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what's being negotiated and where the process stands? Do you want to see it get a vote from Congress sooner rather than later? Do you think uncertainty over a North American trade deal has affected your business or line of work? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. He's with us from the nation's capital. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
Well, let's start with the latest on the impeachment inquiry. The last 2 weeks were filled with public hearings. Now it's moving into a new phase. What's next?
So basically what's happened is the impeachment probe is now kind of being taken over by the Judiciary Committee. Initially, it was with the Intelligence Committee. And so the two next steps in the process. First is that the Intelligence Committee is going to write a report on all the evidence they gathered, both in private depositions and in public hearings over the last couple of weeks. And they'll basically present that to the Judiciary Committee. But it'll basically summarize all the evidence that they've got and sort of make the Democrats' case for impeaching the president, or for potentially impeaching the president. The second thing that's going to happen is this next week, the Judiciary Committee is going to hold its own public hearing to kind of look at the legal framework around impeachment and try to, sort of decide whether the things that have been the president's acts that have been uncovered by the Intelligence Committee, whether, those rise to the level of being impeachable offenses. And what they've essentially said is they're going to bring in, lawyers and other experts to kind of, discuss the kind of constitutional parameters around impeachment. And they've invited the White House to take part, invited the president to send a lawyer to take part. At this point, it doesn't look like the White House is going to do that, but they essentially do have an opportunity to put up their own lawyer to basically make the case that that the conduct that has been, has been revealed in the last number of weeks is not impeachable. So those are really the two next steps that are going to happen. And then after that, it'll be up to the Judiciary Committee to decide, whether or not they want to draft articles of impeachment and submit those to the House for a vote. At this point, it looks likely that they will do that. It's just a question of exactly how they frame the articles of impeachment and what the exact wording is.
Do we have any sense how long this Judiciary Committee phase of the process might take?
The Democrats have generally lean towards having everything wrapped up by the end of the year. So most likely it would probably only be, 2 to 3 weeks that the Judiciary Committee, if they do stick to that timeline, only 2 or 3 weeks that the Judiciary Committee would be doing this work and then drafting the articles of impeachment and then presumably voting on them and sending them to the full House. So, most likely it'll be a relatively swift process. But at this point, the Democrats have not really laid out a hard and fast timeline for how quickly they're going to move. There just is this kind of notion, I guess, that they'd like to have this all wrapped up by the end of the year, at least have a vote on the articles in by the full House by the end of the year.
The public hearing portion of the inquiry has been the big story for weeks now. Do we have any sense, Adrian, whether it has shifted the conversation that lawmakers are having in any way?
It certainly hasn't moved public opinion, in terms of, how many people are convinced of the president's, guilt or innocence. And it definitely hasn't. And I think because of that, it hasn't really shifted where the respective congressional caucuses are at. I mean, it's still very much a partisan divide at this point where, the Democrats seem, the Democrats, I suppose, do seem, more convinced than ever that that going ahead and impeaching the president is the thing to do, is the way to go. But it certainly hasn't. The impeachment hearing certainly didn't shift any of the political calculus for the Republican Party. They're still very much, loyal to the president. And so, it looks very likely at this point that what will probably happen is that the Democratic majority in the House, will approve articles of impeachment against the president and basically set up a trial in the Senate. But it seems very, very unlikely that the Senate, where the Republicans have a majority, would convict Trump and remove him from office. So it's likely that Trump will be impeached by the House, but it's likely that he will be saved by the Senate and ultimately will stay in office.
And new reporting today says that President Trump knew of the whistleblower complaint before he released military aid to Ukraine in September. Why is that piece of news significant?
It basically suggests that Trump was going for a quid pro quo on the military aid, because one of the arguments that Republicans have tried to use during the hearings in the last couple of weeks was that, you know, yes, there was this military aid that was withheld from Ukraine. Yes, you know, President Trump wanted an investigation, you know, Ukraine to do these investigations into his political opponents. But, you know, at the end of the day, Ukraine didn't announce, you know, any such investigations, and they still got their military aid anyway. It was unfrozen in September. So the fact that if Trump really did know, you know, before he released the military aid, that this whistleblower complaint had come forward, it suggests that he didn't release the aid because he wanted to, you know, give the aid to Ukraine. It suggests that he only released the aid because he knew that that it could, you know, very soon Congress might be onto him, the public might be onto him, and might find out what he was trying to do. So it basically is just one more sort of piece of evidence that weighs, you know, the weighs in favor of the case that the president was trying to set up some sort of quid pro quo here by you know, essentially ransoming military aid to Ukraine to get Ukraine to launch these investigations into Biden and the Democrats.
We're talking with Adrian Morrow right now. He's the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. And we're looking at some of the biggest political news out of Washington this week. And Adrian, this week, a federal judge ordered that former White House lawyer Don McGahn must obey a subpoena to testify in the impeachment inquiry. That ruling has now been stayed after the Justice Department appealed it. Can you talk about what's at stake in this particular case?
You know, Don McGahn was one of the key sources for the information in the Mueller report earlier this year, where he basically told Mueller, you know, in detail about times that Trump had tried to have McGahn, or wanted McGahn to fire Robert Mueller, so that Mueller would basically stop investigating, you know, potential Russian collusion by Trump's, you know, campaign and collusion between Trump's campaign and the Russians. And so, you know, McGahn basically provides perhaps the strongest evidence that the Democrats can find that Trump may have attempted to obstruct justice by having Mueller fired. And so having McGahn testify before the impeachment inquiry would be very strong evidence, you know, for the Democrats. You know, at least on the obstruction of justice side. So basically, the White House has tried to stop anybody, you know, who worked for the administration, you know, former like McGahn or current people, from testifying to Congress. And so basically, this legal fight is between, you know, the Democrats in Congress who want McGahn and other White House officials to testify, and the Trump administration that wants to stop all, you know, any of those people from going in front of Congress. And so essentially not only would, you know, McGahn's testimony in itself be valuable to the Democrats in Congress, but if this judge's ruling is held up as a precedent, then it could make it easier for Congress to subpoena, you know, to basically force all these other officials in the White House to come testify before Congress. However, basically what I think the Trump administration is calculating is that, you know, they know that the Democrats want the impeachment inquiry to wrap up relatively quickly, that they don't want this to go on beyond the end of the year. And so I think what they, what their reasoning here is that if they can file as many appeals as possible, kind of use every legal, you know, tool in the tool belt to keep this in the court system, they can basically wait the Democrats out, that they can essentially ensure that, you know, a final ruling, you know, from the Supreme Court or from you know, from any other court on whether or not McGahn and other officials have to testify, they can make sure that ruling happens, you know, months and months down the, you know, down the line, at such a point that it's sort of, you know, long after the Democrats want to have the inquiry wrapped up. So that's sort of where things are at, where the Republicans are the White House rather is trying to ensure that this court process drags out so long that neither McGahn nor anybody else within the White House who's been subpoenaed by Congress will ever actually have to testify.
And before we leave the impeachment topic, President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has been a key figure in the inquiry and in the news a lot this past week. Right now, federal investigators are looking into the actions of two of his associates who have recently been charged with campaign finance violations. What's going on in this aspect of the issue?
Yeah, basically, Giuliani worked with these two associates in Ukraine on a number of things, including attempting to find dirt on Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son. But what's happening now is that both of these guys are charged with allegedly illegally funneling foreign campaign contributions to a pro-Trump political action committee in the U.S. And then on top of that, investigators are looking into whether Giuliani is engaged in either the conduct that his two associates were involved in, or in other business dealings with Ukraine that weren't entirely above board, including being an agent for a foreign government, not registering as an agent, and that sort of thing. What could potentially happen here is that, and it's already started to happen, where the lawyer for one of the guys that Giuliani was working with has talked about how his client is potentially willing to give evidence to the impeachment inquiry, and so it's possible that because of these charges, these associates of Giuliani's might sort of turn on him and be willing to give evidence to Congress that's that's incriminating either for Giuliani on a personal level in his sort of legal situation, or that adds more information to the case against the president. So that's sort of how this could ultimately affect the impeachment inquiry, beyond being obviously potentially legal hot water for Giuliani himself.
We're continuing our talk now with Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail, looking at the week's top political news. And Adrian, let's move on from impeachment and talk about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the trade deal that could replace NAFTA. It's been approved by both Canada and Mexico, but the U.S. Congress has yet to vote on it. Where does it stand?
So right now there's basically a negotiation going on between Democrats in Congress and the Trump administration, where the Democrats basically are saying, we'll only approve your deal and pass it through the House of Representatives if you make certain changes, particularly on labor, the environment, pharmaceuticals, and the enforceability of the deal, only if you make those changes that we want to see. The issue is that a lot of the changes that the Democrats want can only be made if Canada and Mexico agree to them, and Mexico has already, ratified, the new USMCA. So basically, what the Trump administration is trying to do is that they basically want Canada and Mexico to agree to a side letter, which would essentially be an addition to the deal that would, add some things or change some things to please, congressional Democrats. So there's been some back and forth between the Trump administration and the Mexicans over the last few weeks about this. And today what's happening, in a short while here in Washington, is that Chrystia Freeland, the Canadian deputy prime minister, is going to meet with Robert Lighthizer, who's Trump's trade chief, and with Jesus Seade, who's kind of the main Mexican negotiator on the USMCA. And basically, they're going to try to come to some sort of agreement that will basically add, be a side letter that will essentially add some things to the USMCA to please congressional Democrats. So it's essentially going to be a negotiation between the three sides to see what Canada and Mexico are willing to agree to that the Democrats want, that Lighthizer and the Trump administration can take back to Congress and say, okay, is this enough if we give you this for you to pass the deal?
And here's President Trump speaking over the weekend, urging Speaker Pelosi to bring the deal up for a vote.
All she has to do is say, we're putting it up for a vote, like immediately. And a lot of time is being wasted, but you're going to have Mexico and Canada pull it pretty soon. And if they do, it's her fault, not mine. We gave you a great deal. It's her fault.
Adrian, is there talk of Mexico or Canada pulling out of the deal?
No, not at all. Trump is Trump's just making that up. Mexico has already ratified the deal. Canada has committed to ratifying it as soon as the U.S. moves forward on it. So at this point, it really is just a question of, will Canada and Mexico agree to enough of the things that the Democrats want, that's going to be, going to be something that the Democrats will be able to say, okay, that's enough. We sort of got our victory on a couple of points. And so we're willing to do the ratification. At this point, basically the kind of what Trump is basically just trying to do is put pressure on the Democrats by sort of creating this this idea that somehow if this deal doesn't get passed, Canada and Mexico are going to walk away from it. But that's not the case at all. I mean, at this point, I think Canada and Mexico are sort of happy to negotiate, and to sort of see what see where they're able to get.
And you are from Canada. You represent a Canadian newspaper. Is there anything in particular about the discussion in Canada that would be good for us to know?
Well, one of there are really two sort of major things at this point that seem to be on the table in the deal. And ironically, one of the things that that the Democrats want Canada and Mexico to agree to is actually something that Canada and Mexico wanted in the original USMCA negotiations last year, but that the Trump administration refused to give them, which is basically an improvement to the one of the dispute resolution mechanisms, where essentially, there's a process where, you know, when you have a dispute between two of the different countries in the NAFTA deal, under NAFTA, there's a trade tribunal that has to be constituted with members from each country to adjudicate the dispute. And the U.S. Has often used this, has been able to obstruct some of these tribunals from doing their work by just refusing to appoint members to them. And so one of the things that Canada demanded, and I believe Mexico was on board with this too, demanded during the USMCA negotiations, was that they sort of fix this problem and basically, force all three countries to always, appoint members to these tribunals to make sure that these trade disputes could be adjudicated. Lighthizer does not like trade panels. He doesn't, he thinks that they're an impingement on sovereignty. And he thinks that it would be, he basically wanted almost all these trade tribunals to be gutted or abolished entirely in the deal. And so the compromise that they essentially reached on that particular type of dispute resolution was that the status quo would just remain unchanged in the deal. And so ironically now, what the Democrats are demanding is basically that Lighthizer give Canada and Mexico a little bit of what they wanted initially during the negotiations. So I think from Canada's perspective, there could actually be an additional NAFTA victory or USMCA victory if they really do end up incorporating some of this language into the side letter. So that's really maybe the biggest upshot for Canada is the fact that there could be a kind of an additional victory there. The second issue, which I think is going to be much harder, and it's kind of the main issue between the U.S. and Mexico, is that congressional Democrats want provisions in USMCA that would allow American inspectors to go into Mexican factories and ensure that the factories are following some of the tougher labor laws or labor language that Mexico agreed to under USMCA. Mexico doesn't like that idea because they think it's an infringement on their sovereignty to have American inspectors, come onto their turf essentially and inspect their factories. So that one I think will be a harder that might be the Gordian knot that they have to untangle at the negotiating table. But really, those sort of, to me anyway, kind of seem like the two major issues at this point. One of which could be a victory for Canada. If it really does, get into the deal, and you could see a funny alignment between Canada, Mexico, and congressional Democrats against the Trump administration, and then the second one, which could be a much harder negotiation between the U.S. and Mexico.
You mentioned the negotiating table, and of course, we hear a lot from Presidents Trump and Lopez Obrador, and also Prime Minister Trudeau, people like Nancy Pelosi, a Speaker of the House. But who is actually at that table, hammering out these details?
So the three main people are is Chrystia Freeland, who is the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. So she was initially the Foreign Minister and basically handled the original USMCA negotiations in a cabinet shuffle last week after Trudeau's as Trudeau begins his second mandate as Prime Minister. She was shuffled from the Foreign Ministry to be Deputy Prime Minister. So essentially Trudeau's second in command. But she's kept the Canada-U.S. relations portfolio as part of her mandate. So she's the main person for Canada. On the U.S. side, it's Bob Lighthizer, who is the U.S. trade representative. So he's sort of almost the equivalent to a trade minister, that sort of thing in other governments. And his job is basically to handle U.S. trade policy and U.S. trade negotiations. And he's much like Trump. He's pretty much a protectionist, sort of a true believer, economic nationalist type. And so he's very much aligned with Trump kind of ideologically. And then on the Mexican side, it's a guy named Jesus Seade. And he's basically has sort of North American trade as his portfolio. And he wasn't, he was sort of involved a little bit at the very end of the original USMCA negotiations. But those negotiations were mostly handled by the previous Mexican government under Enrique Peña Nieto. And then he kind of came in at the end as a representative of López Obrador, who had won the election, but had not yet taken over as president at the time that the original negotiations were done. But he's now sort of he's López Obrador's guy, basically. And so he's the main person for Mexico kind of handling the talks. So it's really those three basically are the three kind of principals, I guess, at the table who have to hammer this out.
And very briefly, Adrian, in our last half minute or so, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg have joined the Democratic primary slate. Is that going to change much?
That's a good question. I think both of them getting into the race is really a reflection of the fact that that some Democrats, at least in the center, feel a little bit uninspired by Joe Biden and, aren't really sure that there's a strong sort of moderate centrist type candidate who's able to hold back Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, who have, basically tended to run probably the strongest campaigns, or have had sort of the strongest campaigns so far on the left of the party. But that said, there are already so many candidates and so many moderate candidates in the race already. It's really not clear that that Bloomberg or Patrick are going to be able to pull away enough supporters from either Joe Biden or Pete Buttigieg or Kamala Harris.
And we'll leave it there. Adrian, thanks for joining us. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. He was with us for our weekly roundup of the top news coming out of Washington, D.C.